Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
This is Tim Staples of Catholic Answers. I'm excited to let you know that I also teach high school apologetics for homeschoolconnections.com, an online Catholic curriculum provider. There are also recorded independent learning courses at homeschoolconnections.com. Whether you take apologetics with me, literature with Joseph Pierce, or philosophy with Bill Donahue, or any of the other 400-plus courses with homeschoolconnections.com, it's a great way to get Catholic learning for your family.
This episode is brought to you by Hallo, the number one Catholic app. Hallo has 1,000 audio-guided prayers and meditations for you to deepen your relationship with God. To listen to all of the Hallo meditations for free for 30 days, head to hallo.com/breadbox.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the program. My name is William Hemsworth. It's great to be with you all again for today's episode. Pleased to have my guest, Sam Rocha. Sam is, he's an author, he's a speaker, he's a professor as well at the, and he's originally from Texas. And today we're going to talk about socialism. Can a Catholic be a socialist? But Sam, before we get into that, I understand that you have a new title coming out. You're coming out with a podcast pretty soon, is it?
I am. Thanks for asking. Yeah, my podcast is going to be the same title as the book I published in 2015. So the title is Folk Phenomenology. And a lot of it's going to be about folks. So I'm going to be doing some interviews with folks, and I'm going to be doing some more debate-based discussions with folks, including with Trent Horn, who I debated about almost a year ago. Yeah. Now we're going to take that line of argument up again, and then I'll also have some just kind of key concept type monologues by me on some key ideas.
Oh, great!
Thanks for asking. Yeah, it'll come out in June, July. Sorry, July 2021.
July. Okay, great. Yeah. No, I look forward to that. Yeah, I saw that on the announcement on Twitter. So. Very good. Now, for the folks that are listening, maybe not, don't know what phenomenology is. Can you define that for us real quick?
Absolutely. So the word phenomenology just means the study of appearances. Phenomena are things that appear to us. You could also call it the study of things, but that's kind of, it sounds ridiculous. But the idea in phenomenology is that things don't just appear to us in the kind of objective way, they appear to us, the pronoun. In other words, there's our subjectivity has to be engaged with the thing. And so you get this collapsing of the object and the objective on the outside, and then the subject who's taking in the object into their consciousness, and things get really messy at that point. And that's the point that phenomenology really gets excited about. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, July, everyone. So be on the lookout for that. That's exciting. All right. So and before we get started, also, Sam completed his MA and PhD in philosophy of education at The Ohio State University as a Gates Fellow. And apologies for breaking that intro up because my computer decided to do a little freezing on me when I was looking at it. So now, Sam, I've been looking at this subject since your debate with Trent almost a year ago now. It's hard to believe that.
Yeah.
And it seems that people sometimes confuse socialism and communism. Can you define those two and maybe how they're different?
Yeah. I mean, maybe just to back up one step to make sure that I'm clear.
Sure.
Political terms tend to define themselves in the course of history. So if we look at like, what's the meaning of democracy? If we go all the way to Athens and we go to like the original Greek democracies, mm-hmm. They considered elections to be a sign of aristocracy, because they just assumed that all elections would be corrupt. So on an Athenian idea of democracy, free and fair elections have nothing to do with democracy. Yet today, we consider free and fair elections one of the hallmarks of like a well-functioning democracy, right? And so the only reason I say that is that this is actually, I think, a lot trickier than some people allow it to be. So when we say like, what is the meaning of communism? What is the meaning of socialism? Just like, what is the meaning of capitalism, for instance? Right. Like, I have a lot of capitalists who are like, look, I'm not an anarcho-capitalist. I don't believe in unfettered, unregulated free markets. I believe in a capitalism that's constrained by any number of, you know, reasonable things like that. you could say, you know, I'm of the this particular school of thought of capitalism. I'm an Austrian school capitalist, or I'm a Chicago school capitalist, right? Okay. I think this is reasonable for capitalists, and I think the same thing is reasonable for communists, anarchists, socialists, and so on. So one way in which I would distinguish communism, red totalitarian state communism, Mao's communism, Stalin's communism, Castro's communism, from socialism, which I would call either pink, like pinko, so like soft communism, all the way to orange, which is social democracy, democratic socialism, that kind of stuff. I would say the biggest difference is that the socialist is committed to democracy in a way that the communist is absolutely not. For the communist, totalitarianism and the use of dictatorial authority is justified for the sake of the revolution. Whereas for the socialist, in the way I'm talking about, there are no justifications for brute force. Democracy has to be the means through which we achieve the good life or human flourishing.
Okay, and I think that that's a key distinction to point out as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because at least from what I've seen, especially on, you know, Twitter or Facebook, people correlate one with the other. Like, socialism killed millions of people in Russia. Well, did it?
Mm-hmm.
So
right, right. Yeah. I mean, if I could also say, sometimes, though, this is a bad faith move. So in many cases, it's to one's advantage to make one's opponent look like a monster. So it's the whole Hitler game. So if I can, in some sense, associate what one's opponent is saying with something really, really bad, that gives me a pretty easy route to winning an argument. So I find that a lot of people ignore the details on socialism, especially democratic socialism, social democracy, labor politics, workers' parties, these things, because they want to go to the gulag as fast as they can, because it's a really easy way to win an argument. But I don't think that's a rationally good faith way to argue.
Right. So from the Catholic perspective, I guess, what good would socialism have in our society today?
Well, again, for me, this is a concrete question. Well, I think it can be concrete and it can be theoretical. I think it's better to approach it versus the concrete one. So sure. Another way to think about politics or political words like isms, capitalism, socialism, communism, is as modes of political association. In other words, if I say I'm a Democrat, it means I caucus with the Democratic Party and I tend to vote for Democratic candidates. Now, you could say people like, I am a Democrat and I am voting for Ronald Reagan. Okay, you're a very interesting kind of Democrat. You're called a Reagan Democrat, very famous group that voted for Reagan. So this doesn't mean that you are overly constrained, but you associate yourself politically. You caucus with a certain group. And so, for instance, this last election, we saw things like the Lincoln Project and all these Republicans who, they didn't caucus with the Democrats, but they chose to vote for the Democratic Party and even campaign for Biden while still remaining, in their view, Republicans. Now, some of them said, I'm changing my association from one to another. The reason I'm saying all this is that one way that Catholics can understand what it means to be socialism or what is just what are the parties that exist in the world that lots of Catholics, devout, faithful, practicing Catholics are associating with and caucusing in. And so in the case of like in Canada, where I'm at now, even though I'm an American citizen and I vote in the USA, the NDP, the New Democrats Party, is generally considered the Orange Party. That's literally the kind of, and there's a lot of Catholics active in that party, and it goes, and like people like Charles Taylor, who a lot of people will recognize, very famous philosopher, also Roman Catholic, you know, he's been a member of that party for decades and decades. The leader of the Scottish Socialist Party is a traditionalist Catholic, right? So when we think about like what can socialism and Catholicism, it's like it's a great place in some cases, depending on your politics, for Catholics to associate politically with other people who may or may not be Catholics. And this would, in the United States, I think, look like that the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, and the way in which they have a very interesting political pressure they apply to the left side of the Democratic Party, right? Sometimes they do it successfully, sometimes they don't. Bernie Sanders is probably the greatest success story of that story. But obviously we know that success was kind of limited in the US. So the first answer to your question is Socialist parties are great, can be really great places for Catholics to associate and caucus and work on political projects. The more theoretical answer is slightly more complex, I would say, but I think there is a vision of socialism, even from a secular account, that even people like Benedict XVI and others have commented has a it's a bit different, but nonetheless has an enormous amount of overlap with certain secular socialist projects. And some Catholic socialists, like Emmanuel Mounier, a famous French personalist of the Second World War and post-war period, worked really hard to try to develop and bring together Catholicism and personalism with socialism. In Latin America, for instance, there's been a lot of work to try to bring together like the Workers' Party in Brazil before the coup, and those things. And oftentimes they were also associated, though, with the things like the Catholic Action University movement and many of these things. So these histories are mixed and they're kind of messy, but I like to think about it about, like, who do I hang out with?
Okay. Now, in your experience, because I know you've done a lot of these types of things over the past year since that debate with Trent, what have been the biggest objections that you've seen to the compatibility of Catholicism and socialism?
So the biggest objection I face is the one we talked about earlier, which was a definition question. So a number of people just refuse to accept my three examples of Blessed Frassati, Venerable Nerere, and Venerable Camara, who are three historically verifiable socialists. By the way, three very different kinds of socialists. Nerere is African Ujamaa socialism, and also him as a head of state of Tanzania looks very different than Helder Camara in Brazil and Rio de Janeiro, and looks very different than the anti-fascism of Frassati during the time of Mussolini and whatnot. So I was prepared in that debate to really get into the details and to be told, look, you're saying these are three of the same things, but they're actually quite different. And I was willing to concede a lot of ground. Now, I also had a list of 265 others in my pocket that I didn't use because my three weren't challenged, right? A lot of people have rejected this and they said, no, we can't talk about socialism until you give us a definition of socialism. Here, I think, though, I want to say, I think this is an abuse of what definitions are and what they're for. If we are talking about X, and if I can point to X over there and say that's X and then start talking about it, you say, no, we can't talk about the thing you're pointing at over there until we establish conceptually, linguistically, what X is. I'll be like, but you can see X, can't you? I can too. Why can't we talk about it, right? So I think that's been a huge stumbling block for people. In the aftermath, there have been people from the left who have criticized me fairly heavily for being a bit too conservative in that debate, and of being a little bit too antagonistic, for instance, towards anarcho-communists like Kropotkin or Dorothy Day or some of these more radical forms of communitarianism that don't enter into the socialist vocabulary, and dismissing it all as red communism. So I was told that I cut the cake too tight on that side, which I think is right. I think it's true. For instance, Dorothy Day's inability to be called a socialist isn't because she was a capitalist or a libertarian. It's because she was a lot closer, in fact, to red communism through a Kropotkin-like anarcho-communism of sorts. And that was something I didn't want to deal with because I knew it was going to be used strategically or rhetorically, right, as to get me advocating for gulags or something. So I stayed away from it, right? But many people said I shouldn't have done that, that I should have actually given a much broader overview of those things, especially with Dorothy Day's impact for American politics and society. So those are two good objections I've faced. Well, as you can see, I'm more sympathetic to the second one than I am to the first one.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Now, when we talk about socialism, especially here in the United States, is it mostly to do about with just making sure people are taken care of, or do I have that wrong?
No, I think socialism occurs from a concern for people being You could say taken care of. I don't think it's so it's not I don't think it's a paternalistic idea. So a lot of capitalist understandings of the welfare state, for instance, or the so-called nanny state, is where people are incapable of taking care of themselves, and so the state has to step in and take care of them for them. This is where democracy to me is really the linchpin. It's really the key. Demos kratos means people power. And so the idea of democracy from a social democracy point of view is that the state should reflect the people of the state as closely as it can. And so this isn't about breaking apart representative approaches to democracy, because that's very impractical, but it's about breaking the analogy between representation and the actual constituency as much as one can. So it's really about a state that's radically accountable to its people, and then looking there at its people as starting with the bottom of society, those who are most disenfranchised, those who are most disempowered, and those tend to be within any given society the poor and working classes, right? So this isn't about socialism isn't about taking care of those poor, needy people, but it's about having a government that is literally for and of those people, so that their needs can be resolved not by giving them things, but by giving them the power to be a democracy, right? That's the idea.
Okay. So what are some ways here that we can do that, give them the power to do this such thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think in the United States, healthcare is a major is a major issue. First of all, the United States is the only industrialized country in the world that lacks universal healthcare coverage of any kind. Now, there are some universal healthcare coverages that are literally just like state healthcare, but there are mostly a dump bunch of hybrid options, including very different capitalist modes of universal healthcare coverage. Sometimes, like in Japan and in Germany, that means having the state dictate pricings so that the consumer price market remains at a place that's competitive for a consuming. In other cases, it's through hybrid options. So you offer a kind of a minimum amount of basic preventative and palliative care, but then below that you have private medicine to create kind of options, and that way you don't put too much pressure on that part of it and stuff like that. There's numerous examples all around the world, and all of these examples of national healthcare programs, if you look at them politically, they came to be through a socialist or a social democratic party putting pressure on a central government to create this. Oddly enough, in the Catholic Church, our medieval hospitals that we founded all over Europe and all over the world are a great precursor to socialist state healthcare, actually. And in many cases, most of these hospitals and places that were run by the orders and by nuns and stuff work in tandem with national and in many cases socialized medicine as well. So I think that in the United States, for me, healthcare is maybe paramount, even to labor, which is a bizarre thing, I think, for a socialist to say, because it really does imperil so much. And I would also say, I know abortion isn't what people assume a socialist is interested in, but for those who really care about making elective abortion a rarity or abolishing it, I think providing women with natal care, prenatal care, postnatal care, maternal care, maternity leaves, all of these kinds of things that make sacred through policy, and invest in that sacredness through policy. This to me is a pro-life socialism, right? That I'm quite radically in favor of and would fight for. That to me is the first place to work. I think as well, issues of minimum wage, strengthening of unions, antitrust, anti-monopoly legislation, Wall Street regulation. Those are broadly economic planks, I think, of a socialist viewpoint. And of course, here the Democratic Party varies between very much in bed with Wall Street and those who are very much kind of fighting for Main Street.
I want to go back to universal healthcare for a moment. So what you're saying then, it isn't like what some people say, like universal healthcare is where The government is in control of everything. There's no private options or anything like that. It's just establishing that minimum standard. And then if people want to choose to go higher than that, they can.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I'll give you a very concrete example. So I'm in British Columbia. So in Canada, they actually have very provincial healthcare systems. So every province has a very different... So the federal mandate is everyone, every province is responsible for providing its provincial citizens with universal healthcare coverage of some kind up to a certain threshold, right? How they meet that threshold is very different. Manitoba and Ontario have much more socialist, to be honest, healthcare systems, whereas Alberta and British Columbia have much more capitalist healthcare options. And what that means in this case is that in my province, every single person walking, any person who lives here has an identification card, that their healthcare card, for which they can be given a kind of minimum healthcare, whether it's emergency care, preventative care, or palliative care. And this, you know, this is a big thing, but it doesn't cover sort of extras, you might say. And what is an extra? Well, an extra is whatever the state says is an extra. So there's people arguing over this, right? And you can petition things. But then there are clinics who offer care that is maybe not extra, but is in their mind of a different kind of quality. So like ultrasounds and things like that, that if you, and that is supported, that is legal. And people use those private options sometimes in certain cases where they'll pay for it. But that creates a market then for sort of private healthcare. Some people argue that this is unjust because it's capitalist. I'm of the view that actually it actually creates a very interesting way to relieve the main structure of healthcare. And things kind of go on from there. Then you can purchase supplemental care, and so many employers. So I'm UBC, University of British Columbia, supplies me with Sun Life. Sun Life gives me access to dental, optical, and certain things that wouldn't be covered by a public option are covered through Sun Life, which is paid out by my employer, which is based on the salary I negotiate. So that's a totally private capitalist version. This is just one province and one country. If you look at the globe, the variety of options that you can use to establish sensible universal healthcare coverage range from hyper-capitalist universal coverage all the way to state communist socialist options. Like Trent is right about how the Norwegian countries, for instance, the Nordic welfare state, how it's largely supported on behalf of capitalism. And that's absolutely true. But what it shows you is that capitalism and socialism are by no means necessarily opposed to each other. The reason why Texas has no state taxes is because of how much it taxes oil. Exxon's paying your taxes, basically. And it's a good deal because Exxon gets to do basically whatever they want. In many cases, they're not very heavily regulated and stuff. Now, whenever the electrical thing went out a few weeks ago, we saw some limits to this laissez-faire capitalist approach, and I hope there will be sensible ways to address that. But to me, the discussion we're having, which is really refreshing, this is real live adult socialism. It's about policy, it's about resources, it's about how to supply them. And one thing that socialists of my brand are is we're not afraid to work with capitalists or work with capitalist solutions for what we take to be capitalist problems.
Okay. I want to go over a couple of objections that sometimes we really have. You know, some people say the quote from Pope Pius XII about, you know, religion, and I know you're familiar with it, religious socialism, Christian socialism are contradictory terms, and no one can at the same time be a good Catholic and a true socialist. How would you respond to that? Because I know that's thrown around quite a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. We have to look at when that quote comes from, which it's not a recent quote. It comes from the 1930s, 1933, I believe. And the concerns that Rome had about socialist democracy and all these things, they were a part of the concerns I had about modernity all around it. You know, our church is millennia old, and its experience of everything from the Protestant Reformation all the way up, you know, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th century. It was discomforting, and it challenged any number of things. I mean, Rome was not was obviously rejected by the Church of England, but the reactions from Rome to Cromwell and the anti-monarchist sentiment in England and then France were not particularly friendly, right? So I think we have to realize that the church is a temporal structure that has temporal concerns. And I think whenever you are watching the USSR form and enter into this literal world war with rising fascism, you know, you have a lot of concerns. And the concerns of the church were definitely aimed at the totalitarian forms of communism, just as they were also concerned in some cases about fascism. But here, this is embarrassing to admit, but it was difficult to not support Franco early because the communists were so fiercely secular and anti-Catholic. But then whenever they were Catholic anti-fascists and Franco started executing them, things get really messy here. And that's the history of Europe during the time when this was written. And when we take that into mind, the full historical difficulties coming into mind, I think we can see that there's a real break in the wind. And I didn't have time to make this argument in the debate. But if you read John Paul II, no one is perhaps as attuned to state communism as John Paul II is. Because he's Polish, right?
Right.
Watch the way he writes after the fall of the Berlin Wall. I don't have the passage in front of me because I didn't bring any proof texts here to bring you. But you'll notice that he talks about the old socialism, the communism that is now gone. In other words, John Paul II saw the fall of the Berlin Wall as a real political victory for a particular way of life, being of a free society, of a tolerant society, of a liberal society, if we want to call it. And after that, we don't see the 1933 condemnations, or we don't see the church talk this way about socialism. And I wonder why. Well, I can tell you exactly why. And any thinking, rational person can tell you why. It's because the Berlin Wall failed and the USSR failed. And the experiment of communism within Western Europe and Central Europe was a unmitigated failure. And we had to pick up from there. My socialism in 2020 is a socialism that takes full stock of that failure and wants to pick up from there and believes that the church has a broad ability to continue this work. And if you look at like the church has condemned Aristotle. Can you imagine that? The church condemns Aristotle before Thomas Aquinas.
Well, crazy.
It's crazy, but it made sense at the time. If you read why the church condemned Aristotle at the time that they did, you can be sympathetic to that. Yet you can also see how Aquinas changed the game. He completely changed the game. We have had mystics and church fathers who have been censored by Rome. Because at the moment when they were writing, Teresa of Avila is what I'm thinking of here, it wasn't clear whether this was mysticism or who knows, paganism, right? Mm-hmm. And then after time changed, the church changed pastorally. This isn't a change in the kind of willy-nilly relativist sense. It's the fact, though, that the church is a temporal structure, comments temporally and adjusts temporally. And I think that the conversation on socialism is very different in a pre-world and post-World War II setting as it is in a post-Berlin Wall setting. And I think there's a lot of Catholics in the U.S. who like to take up a pre-Berlin Wall approach to talking about socialism, a Cold War, Red Scare approach. But you know what? Baby, that ship is past. We are in 2020. Yeah. That's over now.
Yeah, great point. You never thought, and thank you for coming on, because I never thought of any of this, to be honest with you, until that debate. So it's great to have you on just to discuss it. Now, before we end, Sam, is there any closing remarks that you want to say as to why it's okay for a Catholic to embrace socialism?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I appreciate you having me on. I really do appreciate every person for whom the word socialism probably triggers any number of bells and associations that are negative. I just want to honor the fact that it's almost been a year now, and a lot of people have bent their ear and have given a place for this discussion to happen that I believe is good in and of itself. Like, whether or not you think socialism or capitalism or hybrid forms, whatever you think on the details, the fact that one can take seriously ideas that may seem a bit scandalous, as long as reason and truth are firmly on the table and guiding our discussions, I think this is just really important. And so I want to put that out there first. The second point I want to make is that I think the real heart and soul of this, as I've thought about this more, is actually not about socialism. I think it's about democracy. Okay. And I think that as Catholics, we can probably have some variety of opinion about the importance of practical social solutions. But I do believe that more and more, a Catholic in today's time cannot be openly opposed to democracy in a way that slides into a kind of illiberalism of sorts. Now, I know liberalism has problems, and there's a lot of liberalisms out there, and we don't have time to go into that now. But I think that there's been an assumption that one can just easily switch from liberalism to illiberalism and find oneself in these kind of pseudo-monarchist, minarchist, integralist, theocratic. I mean, we can look to Iran and to the Ayatollah and see, like, theocracy is a real experiment. And you know what? There's some interesting conversations to be had. But I don't believe that a Catholic today can so openly flaunt in the face of democracy, if by democracy we mean demos kratos, people power, the idea that a collection of people ought to have their dignity recognized at the highest hierarchical levels of authority. This commitment to me is a commitment that I see across Pope Francis's writings and Benedict XVI's writings and John Paul II's writings, the three popes of my lifetime. And I don't believe at this point in time it is really an optional position for Catholics regarding their social Catholic social teaching. I think we have to be Democrats, but we can be Republican Democrats. But we still have to be committed to a certain minimum standard of democracy. And I think this is really the heart and soul of my politics these days. And I hope that it's useful for you all to think about.
Okay, great. Now, Sam, where can our listeners get a hold of you, reach out to you to learn more about you if they wanted to?
Yeah, so just my website, my name, samrocha.com. So if you go to my website there, if you click around, I have a long, long bio. So you can kind of get to know me a bit, know kind of what I'm into and what I do, what I've been up to. And then there's a page with my books. I've published mostly academic titles on education. My day job is as a philosopher of education. And then my music. I've been a performing and recording artist since a church musician at stage 5 or 6. So that's a big part of me and my life and the work that I do. And then please keep your eye out for my podcast, as you so helpfully Absolutely. Plugged at the very beginning. Yeah.
Yeah. And as soon as you get to first thing on your website is a video of you playing the guitar.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That thing changes sometimes, but you know, there's a funny relationship actually between the fine and performing arts, and especially music and folk music in this country, in the United States, and politics. And so, you know, I think a lot of people could understand socialism better if they just listen to Woody Guthrie, and they realize that, guess what, socialism in America is as American as Woody Guthrie. You go and tell me that that's un-American. You know, I'm going to play this, you know, this land is my land. This land is your land, right? This land was made for you and me. Woody Guthrie's guitar said, "This machine kills fascists." To me, this right. folk tradition of music came from the people, and it was the voice of the people. And it was the songs of protest against the coal mine, against the steel mill, against the copper mine. And these were the songs of ordinary people. That, my brothers and sisters, to me is not just socialism, but I think it's also a kind of theology. And I think it's really important. And I think it's time to get over the Red Scare and recognize that the Berlin Wall has fallen, but Woody Guthrie still sings.
All right, great. Sam, I thank you for coming on. A lot of great information that I never considered personally. That's why I wanted to have you on. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate your time.
All right, God bless.
All right, cheers.
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.